This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava, sitting in for Ray Suarez. Buddhism is on the rise in the U.S. More Americans, celebrities and non-celebrities alike, are embracing it, in particular, Tibetan Buddhism. The leader of Tibetan Buddhism is the Dalai Lama. Religion gets tied up in politics in this case, as the Dalai Lama has been living the past 39 years in exile from Tibet, which China took over in the 1950s. The Free Tibet movement, which has gained popularity of late, is part of the effort to redress that. But the religion itself, exactly what is it? What is the system of beliefs that is attracting more people in the West? Some say that Tibetan Buddhism offers a refuge from the materialism of the West. Yet one of our guests this hour suggests that some of the West may have found its way into the Tibetan Buddhism that is now being embraced. Tibetan Buddhism is today's talk of the nation, and with us this hour are Donald Lopez, Jr., professor of Buddhist and Tibetan Studies, Asian Languages and Cultures Department at the University of Michigan. He is also author of the recently published Prisoners of Shangri-La, Tibetan Buddhism in the West. And Donald Lopez joins us from the studios of WUNC-FM in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And with us here in Studio 3A is Buchung Sering, director of the International Campaign for Tibet, a nonprofit and human rights group that is based here in Washington. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And you may join us as well at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Well, I'd like to make this a primer at first of explaining exactly what Tibetan Buddhism is. So I'd like to start with you, Professor Lopez. How would you define Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, Tibetan Buddhism has a long and a variegated history. I think that one of the problems that we encounter is trying to describe it in 25 words or less, just as if we ask someone to describe the essence of Christianity or the essence of Judaism, we would get into all kinds of problems. I think there's a similar difficulty here in essentializing Tibetan Buddhism as a specific set of practices where in fact it has a very wide and variegated history, as I say. But briefly, we can say that Buddhists came into Tibet in the 7th century, primarily at the royal court. And over the centuries, a tradition of translation and practice developed that goes on until this day, even in exile in India and Nepal.
Mm-hmm. So it began in India, and now the Tibetan Buddhism is exiled to India since China
took
over.
Back to India, that's right. There's an irony about that, certainly, that the Tibetans were forced out of their own country back to the original homeland of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Buchung Sering, do you want to take a try at explaining what Tibetan Buddhism is?
I think, in short, Tibetan Buddhism is the Buddhism that the Buddha taught in India with a Tibetan cultural component.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what about that Tibetan cultural component? How would that have changed what the Buddhism practiced in India originally was compared to what it was practiced in Tibet?
I think I won't go far as to talk about how Buddhism was practiced in India, but in Tibet, Buddhism, as I know, was practiced in two different categories. One, the monastic community, the clergy, had a way of practicing Buddhism, which meant a deeper study of the philosophy and the ability to understand the religion and to improve their personal well-being, personal development, as well as the development of the community. The other category is the lay population. To the lay population, the practice of Buddhism was imbibed in their day-to-day life. They did not normally indulge in the deeper philosophical studies that the clergy did. To them, serving the monastic community was in itself a Buddhist act. And that, in short, is how Buddhism was practiced.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donald Lopez, tell us a little more about that, about the differences there. What are some of the things that one would have done as a Tibetan Buddhist that was different?
Well, again, we need to perhaps not draw such a sharp distinction between lay and monastic practice. I think we have the sense in the West that Tibetan monks spent all their time meditating or studying Buddhist philosophy, whereas they were involved in a lot of ritual practices in which the laity were also involved. There was a long practice of pilgrimage, the recitation of mantras, Of course, meditation was there, but I think, again, that gets overemphasized in our representations of Buddhism in the West, whether it's Zen or Tibet or whatever. Again, it's a vast topic, and there were elements that came from India as well as Tibetan kind of innovations, one might say.
Mm-hmm. Now, what of tenets of the faith? I mean, what would some of those have been?
Well, I guess we would want to begin with the idea of karma and rebirth, as we have in other Buddhist cultures, the idea that one's deeds, whether good or bad, determine the future. So that if one behaves virtuously, one will find happiness in the future. If one behaves in a non-virtuous way, one will find unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, then extends over many lifetimes, and therefore the doctrine of reincarnation is very important in Tibet and throughout the Buddhist world. I guess one of the things that we might point to of interest that occurs in Tibet and does not occur in other Buddhist cultures is the idea of the reincarnate Lama, the most famous of whom is the Dalai Lama, of course, the idea that enlightened beings, out of their compassion for the universe, do not go into nirvana upon death, but they come back in lifetime after lifetime, and that unlike the ordinary cycle of rebirth, in which one has no real control over one's future place of birth, these incarnate lamas can choose where they're going to be reborn, who the parents are, and all that sort of thing. And furthermore, Tibetans believe that these incarnate lamas can be identified so that someone can go and find a 3 or 4 year old child and say, this is the next reincarnation of this recently deceased great lama. And the Dalai Lama is, of course, the most famous of these, but there were about 3,000 such lines of incarnation in Tibet.
Mm-hmm. And he is the 14th in that line.
He's the 14th in that line, that's correct.
What are some of the criteria for choosing a 3 or 4 year old child, a male child, to be the Lama, Mr. Sering?
Yeah, I think it's a very deep religious process. There's no set rules in finding out a typical Lama, but I think because it's a spiritual process, you have to depend on lots of signs and indications. For example, if you take the case of the 14th Dalai Lama, His Holiness was found primarily due to signs and indications that the search party found first in the lake. There's a holy lake in Tibet where if you meditate and pray, you believe to see visions in the lake, which sort of indicates where the next Lama would be born. In the case of His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, a vision was seen by the regent in the lake. Thereafter, that vision led these people to a village in northeastern Tibet. And there they found a young boy. And that boy was put through a test involving identification of the personal things of the previous Dalai Lama. And thereafter, that and other tests and some of the dream, I think, of the parents all put together brought to fact that this was indeed the reincarnation of the 14th Dalai Lama. So this is the general process that reincarnation of any Lama is recognized.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that one hears the adherents of Tibetan Buddhism here in the West, in the U.S., is that it gets away from materialism of the West. It's seen as a refuge from that. There's this gentleness associated with it. And I'm wondering if you can talk about this a little bit, about what are some of the things that give us that impression? What are tenets of the faith that lead us to have that impression, those of us who are not adherents? Donald Lopez.
Well, I think a great deal of that comes from the Dalai Lama himself, who is considered to be the human incarnation of compassion. And he has been a very eloquent spokesperson for the practice of compassion, the need to benefit others. And he himself talks a great deal about the responsibility to help others in the world. And so as a bodhisattva, that is someone who has dedicated himself to the welfare of all beings in the universe, he has been a very eloquent spokesperson for this doctrine. But again, I think that a good part of this emphasis really is a direct result of the Dalai Lama's own notoriety in the West. And perhaps when we look more closely at Tibetan Buddhist practice, particularly in traditional Tibet, it's a somewhat more complicated picture.
What do you mean?
Well, That is, every religion has its own doctrinal controversies, sectarian problems, and those things existed in Tibet as well. I don't think we should be at all surprised by the fact of their existence, but I think that we've come to romanticize Tibet so much that people are somewhat disturbed by the fact that Tibetans didn't always get along with each other. There's a kind of Shangri-La syndrome at work in which Tibet is depicted as kind of Buddhist utopia. And since utopia does not exist anywhere on earth, it also did not exist in Tibet.
Yes, Professor Lopez, who are these people who you say are considering Tibet as this utopia? And I've been reading your book. First of all, I should say that I really enjoyed it because it gives lots of information. And to me, as a young Tibetan who was searching his identity, it gave me quite a bit of information that I had not known before. But at the same time, it brought certain concerns in me, and one of these is what you said just now. You seem to be pointing out some unidentified people who tend to think that Tibet is a utopia, Tibet of the past is a utopia. As a Tibetan who has grown up in India, who has lived briefly in Europe and now who is living here in the United States, I have come across people, supporters of Tibet. Maybe in the past, in the 60s, there would have been cases when, because of Tibet's remoteness, there would have been situations where people were lured more towards the fantasy, the exotism. But that you can expect from any remote areas. It's not just something... peculiar to Tibet. Maybe you yourself in a way are contradicting yourself by saying that we shouldn't expect Tibet to be this and this, but you seem to be implying that people seem to be expecting it.
Donald Lopez, are people expecting, reading more into Tibet than is there? Is that what you're saying? More
into
Tibetan Buddhism?
Absolutely. I don't think that Tibet is just another unknown place in the world. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to look at the fantasies that have circulated around Tibet over the centuries. If I could just trace some of those for a moment. One of the things that we learned from Freud is that behind every fantasy there is a desire or an interest. And these interests often have almost nothing to do with Tibet, the place, and Tibetans who live there, but rather have to do with Western projections onto this very remote and, in the Western eyes, exotic place.
I mean, because it's far away and it has been isolated, therefore it has a mystery about it, and the Westerners who went there would read into it more because of that?
Well, there weren't that many Westerners who went there. That is, mm-hmm. many of the people who talked about Tibet were those who never visited the country. But I do think that Tibet is unique to a certain extent because Tibet never became a European colony. I think this is a crucial factor. We know that there were many fantasies about India and China in the 18th century. For example, in the French Enlightenment, people like Voltaire looked to China as a place of enlightened government by the Mandarins. The German Romantics looked to India as an abode of the spirit. But once these regions came under European colonial power, the exoticism and the romanticization of these cultures really sort of declined and really sort of became absorbed back and back and back and across the Himalayas until they landed in Tibet. And so Tibet, as sort of the last place in Asia that did not come under European colonial domination, absorbed many of the European fantasies about the spiritual and the exotic. So that, for example, we have Alexander Choma de Koros, the person who is considered the father of Tibetology, of the academic study of Buddhism, going to Tibet because he thought that this was the homeland of the Hungarian people, and he was looking for the original place of his language. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical Society, believed that the enlightened masters held the secrets of Atlantis and that they lived in Tibet, but Tibetans didn't know that they were there.
But Professor Lopez, if I may interject, isn't that the way all knowledge is born? First, you have this sort of desire to know something. Maybe that's a wrong notion. But as in when you go into the field and try to search for it, you tend to find out the real stuff there. Maybe Alexander Choma de Koros had a wrong notion of feeling that the Tibetans were the of people from whom the Hungarians descended. But when Alexander went there, a knowledge was born, wasn't it?
Yes, he did do the first dictionary and so forth. The knowledge is produced. But,
yeah, so that wasn't a fantasy, right?
My point really is that there are these interests that lead people to fantasize about Tibet, and whether or not knowledge is created from this process, these interests remain very much in play. And these interests, I would like to argue, are really counter to the cause of Tibetan independence.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation. Our subject today is Tibetan Buddhism. You're listening to Donald Lopez and to Buchung Sering. And if you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Well, talk to us a little bit about that, Donald Lopez. You're suggesting that by not having a clear view on what Tibetan Buddhism is, it hurts the cause for Tibetan independence from China.
Yes, my point is that to the extent that we consider Tibet a repository of lost wisdom that is somehow going to save the West from itself, to the extent that we consider Tibet as having been entirely a nonviolent society, in which the people were devoted entirely to the practice of Buddhism, to the extent that we romanticize Tibet, we turn Tibet into a place that doesn't exist. We turn it into a utopia. And as we know, utopia means no place. There are millions of Tibetans living under Chinese colonial rule now, and I think our political concerns have to be turned toward them and away from this idea that Tibet is somehow going to save us from ourselves.
Professor Lopez, yeah, can I get back to my question again? Who are these people you say who are having these sort of notions, this utopia concept or Tibet as an ideal country? Because I belong to the International Campaign for Tibet. And my
I do too.
My organization, if you are a member, you would have known that it grew from less than 3,000 members 4 years back to around 25,000 members now. And all these additional members, they didn't join International Campaign for Tibet, not because they thought it was promoting a fantasy, it was promoting a utopian concept for Tibet. I think all each and every of these members know very well what the situation in Tibet is. And they've been brought into the issue through events which you may tend to depict as fantasizing the issue of Tibet.
Donald Lopez, or are you suggesting not so much the people that join a political campaign, but are you suggesting the people who would embrace Tibetan Buddhism on the idea of this utopia? I do want to be clear on that.
No, certainly. I think that a good deal of the support for the Tibetan cause does come from the fact that the cause of Tibetan independence is an almost irresistible combination of the exotic, the spiritual, and the political. From the exotic point of view, we have Tibet as this distant place located in the Himalayas, isolated and so forth. From the spiritual point of view, we have the practice of Buddhism being threatened by communism, and Tibet being identified as a preserve of a pure Buddhist tradition. And from the political point of view, we have what is depicted as an invasion of godless communists, causing this pure Buddhism to be exiled from its own nation. So once we have those three factors at work, I think that the Tibetan interest in Tibet becomes almost irresistible to a certain extent.
I think there's just a minority of people who hold that sort of view. Of course, there are people, even though they may be told a thing many times, they still tend to have their own concept of the issue. But on the issue of Tibet, I think things have moved so rapidly in the last several years. For example, again, let me go back to some concrete points. The Students for a Free Tibet, these are organizations 5 years from now. There were just a dozen or so of the chapters of the Students for a Free Tibet. Today, there are over 300. And this increase in the number of Students for a Free Tibet are not because these young students believed Tibet as a utopian concept. I think these people, as are members of the International Campaign for Tibet, are all very much concerned about the human rights aspect of the Tibetan issue, about the political, deeper political implications of the Tibetan issue, and therefore they're interested in Tibet, not because they think that Tibet before the Chinese arrival was a dreamland. We Tibetans even don't say that. We Tibetans accept that fact that there were drawbacks in the past society, in Tibetan society. Even the Dalai Lama, as soon as he came into exile from Tibet, he said that now at a public talk, he did say that if and when we get back to Tibet, we cannot go back to the old Tibet. He even went to the extent of saying that we cannot go back to the semi-feudal Tibet. And so no Tibetan, at least, is expecting to go back to some, as you may call it, mythical Tibet.
Well, I'm wondering, though, Butchung Sering, if I'm understanding Donald Lopez correctly, I think he's saying that the allure for some people to embrace Tibetan Buddhism is that it's something other than what they grew up with. It's foreign, and therefore it's better than any religion that they might have been available to them when they grew up here. And that's why it's embraced, because of its exoticness. Am I understanding you correctly there, that might be?
Yes,
So is there some element of that? And also, it's a political cause. There's Tibet, you know, small Tibet against giant China. And so it makes it very alluring and very attractive.
Yeah, definitely. These would be there in any case, not just with Tibet. For example, in the case of religion, and Professor Lopez, you have, in fact, reflected that in your book, where the Dalai Lama said, Tibetan Buddhism is appropriate for some section of the community. It's like each people has his own mental disposition, and to some, Tibetan Buddhism may offer a better way of having a self-development and bringing spiritual happiness, whereas to some other people, some other religion may be bringing that sort of happiness. And obviously, as I said earlier, at first you may come to the issue, the political aspect of the Tibetan issue or the religious aspect of the Tibetan issue, through may a sense of attraction. But once you start taking a deeper study, then you do find that there are concrete things, whether it's in the religious aspect or in the political aspect.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. If you'd like to join us, we're talking with Butchung Sering and Donald Lopez about Tibetan Buddhism. And let's go to John in St. Louis right now. Hi there, John.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you doing?
Listen, I'm a young student of Kagyu lineage Buddhism, and I would like the guest to comment on Steven Seagal being recognized as a tulku.
Okay. Donald Lopez, would you like to take that one?
Yes. As we talked about in the opening, there is this institution in Tibetan Buddhism of incarnate lamas being identified. And one of the things that I discuss in the book is the way in which we can trace the spread of Tibetan Buddhism in the increasingly larger geographical circles in which these incarnate lamas are identified. So that in we first find these lamas identified in Tibet, and then in Mongolia, in China, in Nepal. And just in the last 20 years or so, we've begun to see incarnate lamas or tulkus being identified in the West. 20 years ago, there was a young boy in Montreal who was identified. More recently, there was a young boy in Seattle. Really, after Bertolucci's film, The Little Buddha came out, we have a case of life imitating art, in which a young boy was identified as the incarnation of an important Lama, Desheng Rinpoche, a young boy in Spain. So I think we can see that the support and patronage of Tibetan Buddhism is expanding by looking at the fact that we're now finding incarnate lamas being identified in the West. Now, the Steven Seagal case is an interesting one, because traditionally in Tibetan Buddhism, although it's not unheard of, it's almost always the case that the child is identified at a very young age, 3 or 4 or 5 years old. Here we have a man over 40 being identified as a Tibetan Lama. And the fact that he is a kind of an action movie star, I think, has produced a good deal of chagrin in the Tibetan community over his identification, although I must say that the Lama who identified him, Penno Rinpoche, is a highly respected figure.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I'm curious, Butchung Sering, you're a Tibetan Buddhist. What do you make of Steven Seagal having this honor bestowed on him?
I know the issue is quite controversial, but I'm not here to defend Steven Seagal. I don't know him personally. I see his movies sometimes. But if you go by technical rules of Buddhist principles, no one can deny that he is not a reincarnated being. I don't think I am enlightened enough to say that he is not so. Professor Lopez may agree with me. We Buddhists believe that in each of us there is this Buddha nature. And although environmentally it's quite uncomfortable to see that Steven Seagal, old...
Because he's not the calm image.
Right. He's not
branding
sort of
it an Uzi
the normal
and,
image yeah. that you might have of a typical Lama. But at the same time... you cannot, Buddhism is a rational religion, and if you question, if the Lama were to tell you, how do you know that he's not a reincarnated being, I don't have an answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think because it is a rational religion that we should be able to question those sorts of things. And
yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course, we have to question, but I'm saying that we cannot say that he's not it.
Well, Donald Lopez, if you were to ask the question, how would you press the case? I mean, what would you say? What were the questions you'd have?
Well, my questions would be really, you know, what kind of financial support has Stephen Segal given in order, in return for being this, having this honor bestowed upon him? What kinds of signs? I mean, all of this sort of goes into the mystical unknown in terms of the identification. But I'm much more interested in it as a cultural phenomenon of having not only a young Western boy identified, but now a full-grown kung fu star. So those were the sorts of questions I would be more interested in than sort of the mystical reasons that led to his identification. Well, I must say, however, that I think there is a certain amount of bad press given to the Hollywood kind of glitterati who are adherents of Tibetan Buddhism. When we go back and look at the spread of Buddhism historically, it's always been the case that Buddhism has entered a new culture through its royalty. Through the royal court, whether we're talking about China or Japan or Tibet, Buddhism first catches on at court, and I guess the Hollywood stars are our royalty.
Indeed. And we'll get more from Donald Lopez and Buchung Sering when we return after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Melinda Penkava. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Tibetan Buddhism is the talk of the nation today. We're also taking email at totn@npr.org or by regular mail. It'll take a few days, but that address is Talk of the Nation Letters, NPR News, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. And at 33 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava, in for Ray Suarez. Today we're talking about Tibetan Buddhism. What is its allure today in the West, and how has it changed over time? Our guests are Donald Lopez, professor of Buddhist and Tibetan Studies in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Michigan. He is the author of the recently published Prisoners of Shangri-La, Tibetan Buddhism and the West. And Buchung Sering, director of the International Campaign for Tibet, a nonprofit human rights monitoring and advocacy group here in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We'll go to Phil in Brockton, Massachusetts now. Hi there, Phil.
Hi, Tashi Dalai. I have been a student of Tibetan Buddhism for 30 years, and I don't view Buddhism as a religion, but as a mind science, a psychology that combines wisdom along with compassion to make you truly effective in what you do. What Buddha enunciated 2,500 years ago was a way to get beyond suffering. And the way to get beyond suffering is to calm yourself, to relieve yourself from passion, from greed, from jealousy, from anger. And only when you can control your own mind can you be truly effective in what you do. Thank you. I'll listen on the radio.
Okay. Thanks, Phil. Anybody want to comment on that? Donald Lopez?
I wasn't sure what the question was. That certainly, I think, a traditional representation of Buddhist philosophy, but I would, I guess, resist the idea of calling it a science. I think Buddhism is a religion just like any other, and the elements that Phil mentioned are certainly there among many others.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Buchung Sering?
Yeah, I have nothing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's his point of view.
Okay, indeed. Well, Donald Lopez, your book is titled Prisoners of Shangri-La, and I just was wondering if you might explain a bit about what you're talking about there.
Well, of course, the term Shangri-La comes from James Hilton's 1933 novel Lost Horizon, in which some people are kidnapped and taken to Shangri-La, not really allowed to leave. And when they leave, they enter into history at their own peril. And what I try to talk about in the book is the way that the various fantasies about Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism have really formed a kind of mindset, which really is something that, in a certain sense, imprisons Tibetans and Tibetophiles and scholars of Tibetan Buddhism, a prison whose walls that we really need to be able to measure and delineate. And one of the things that I do in the book is to try to identify the confines of this prison and how it was built, and because I think it's a prison that we need to try to escape from in order to put forward the cause of Tibetan independence, which I think is really the ultimate goal.
Well, is this a prison, in your view, that the walls have come up more since China took over Tibet, or less?
Well, I guess one of the things that's interesting is the wild fluctuation in the valuation of Tibetan Buddhism that we've seen over the last century. 100 years ago, Tibetan Buddhism was seen as the most corrupt form of Buddhist practice.
Among
Western scholars of Tibetan Buddhism, so corrupt, in fact, that it didn't really deserve the name Buddhism, but was called something Lamaism, a term which we still see and which Jiang Zemin used in his press conference with President Clinton recently. Now, since the Tibetan diaspora, Tibetan Buddhism has been perceived as the most pure and pristine form of Buddhism because it was not tainted by Western intervention in the 19th and early part of the 20th century. So there's a kind of play of opposites at work here, which I try to set forth. And those in themselves, I think, can be imprisoning the ways in which Tibetan Buddhism gets essentialized by the operation of stereotypes and adjectives.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Professor Lopez, what's this mindset that you were talking about that we're trying to imprison ourselves with?
Well, I think one of the great dilemmas that faced the Tibetans when they came out of Tibet in 1959 was that, of course, any community that has to leave its country under duress faces incredible hardships. The Tibetans faced these as they came down from 12,000 feet to the Indian Plateau and suffered the ravages of tuberculosis and other diseases. But the other thing I think that was unique about Tibet was that the Tibetans left Tibet and came into exile to find themselves strangely already there. That is, there was a strange kind of distorted mirror image of Tibetan Buddhism that was had been circulating in the West for almost a century, to which the Tibetans had to accommodate themselves. And that accommodation has occurred fitfully. It's certainly gone through a number of different changes, as Bujung Tsering has enumerated. But nonetheless, I think this still remains a problem.
Could you give an example of those accommodations you're talking about?
Well, again, as I was discussing earlier, there has always been this sense of Tibet somehow serving the West, whether it's Hilton Shangri-La, where the treasures of Western art are kept for an impending Holocaust, whether it's Timothy Leary using the Tibetan Book of the Dead as kind of a flight plan for an acid trip in the 1960s. There's a kind of strange continuity between these views of Tibet, which I think we would now want to at least charitably describe as eccentric, and the kind of talk that we see about Tibet being this sort of a repository of ancient wisdom, which is going to save the materialist West. So what I'm trying to trace there is not so much to talk about the current scene, but to show how these rather strange views of Tibet have evolved over the centuries into the view that we have today. And I would not want to say that all of those views have been entirely dispelled.
Bujung Tsering?
Professor Lopez, to the extent that you say that the world community needs to have a proper understanding of the Tibetan situation, I agree with you. But I think you're pointing at some of these things which are part of the popular culture. And I'm sure you'll agree with me that you're also a product of that popular culture, you and other Buddhist scholars. And I think the way you contribute to the knowledge of Buddhism in general and Tibetan Buddhism in particular in the international community and through your books, they're all part of this fantasy, if I may say so. So what's wrong with that?
As I say in the introduction to the book, we're all prisoners of Shangri-La. I include myself in that process. But I think, nonetheless, the existence of the prison needs to be acknowledged.
Okay. And let's go to some calls right now, because we do have many people here on the line. Joe in Carlinville, Illinois. Hi there, Joe.
Good afternoon, Ms. Pinkava.
Good afternoon.
And your honored guests. I ran into an old classmate of mine, and we had a chance to talk, and it turns out that she was studying Tibetan Buddhism in Chicago with Professor Thurman. And I hesitate to say this because we've already talked about celebrities. He so happens to be the father of Uma Thurman, but that's just
incidental. But he is the first monk, American Tibetan Buddhist monk, and
right.
A scholar on the subject.
I view that as just being incidental, though, that she's his daughter.
Okay.
I first came to the study of Buddhism through the Rinzai school, as opposed to the Zozo school of Zen Buddhism. And I was very interested to hear about the notion of bodhisattvas and right livelihood. I wish you could comment on that. And I'm also interested in the American notion in the Gelug sect, which I believe is the sect which His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama practices, and so many Americans also do, about the fact that Dorje Shugden is a manifestation of the Buddha, or so many Americans would say, and in the Gelug sect. And His Holiness has said that this deity is not to be worshipped as a manifestation of the Buddha, that in fact he might have certain demonic characteristics. So there's a split right there. I wish you could talk about that. I ask this in the spirit of seeking enlightenment, and I'm asking you to teach howsoever you can. And I wanted to also find out the idea about in Buddhism in general, and Tibetan Buddhism specifically, about the notion that we are supposed to transcend the various attachments such as fear, hungers for power, sex, these various things which hold us back.
Okay, well, I'm going to go with your question on the Dorje Shugden, and we'll pose that first to Donald
Lopez.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you so much, Joe. Okay, Donald Lopez, what of this? There's this, the Dalai Lama came out several years ago and said that the worship of this particular deity in Tibetan Buddhism should not continue. And there has been a rift, to put it mildly, within Tibetan Buddhism about this. Can you give us a few of the details there?
Yes, very briefly. It's a long and complicated story, but briefly, Dorje Shugden is a protective deity. Protectors are very important in Tibetan Buddhism as kind of a personal deity who protects one in situations of danger, who provides wealth and those sorts of things. Dorje Shugden has traditionally been seen as one of the protectors of the Gelug sect, to which the Dalai Lama belongs. But for about the past 20 years, there has been some controversy over this issue, because Dorje Shugden is a sectarian protector. That is, he protects the Gelugs, but not the other major sects of Tibetan Buddhism. So the Dalai Lama, in a spirit of ecumenism, I think, has asked Tibetans to desist from the worship and propitiation of Dorje Shugden. And the worshippers of Dorje Shugden, both among Tibetans and among some of the Western followers of some Tibetan lamas, have resisted that. And unfortunately, in 1997, three Tibetan monks, including a very prominent scholar, were murdered. And the murder has been attributed, but not proved, to be connected with the Dorje Shugden controversy.
Mm-hmm. Is this one of the areas where, by telling the followers to go away from this particular deity, is that one of the things that the Dalai Lama may have done to accommodate the West some more? Because this is a deity. This gets to the whole idea of idols, which in the West is not seen in a good light. So is this a part of the Buddhism that the Dalai Lama maybe wanted to push away, and it makes it more acceptable to more Western adherents?
No, I don't think so. I think it's really the Shugden controversy was really an internal controversy within the refugee community. It was a controversy that's gone on for the past 20 years in the Tibetan language, and only surfaced a couple of years ago because of some Western followers of Shugden. But it's nothing to do with idolatry. Tibetan Buddhists believe, like all Buddhists, that images contain the Buddha, that they are animated images that can bless and cure and those sorts of things. And so the fact that Shugden is found in an image sometime is irrelevant to the controversy.
Mm-hmm. Bujung Seri? Any comment on the Shugden controversy?
Yeah, I think the existence of this controversy in itself shows that Buddhism is a vibrant religion, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism. And of course, whatever religion you practice, there's bound to be disputes, doctrinal disputes, confusion, and these are part of the religious process. The important fact is that I think I agree with Professor Lopez in this, that the issue has been sort of exaggerated to the extent it is today on account of use of Western mechanism to tackle a distinctly Tibetan issue.
I'm curious, though, in a free Tibet, if there were a free Tibet, would there be that freedom of religion, so that the Dalai Lama may be saying that his followers should not practice this, but would those people who wanted to be able to still worship this deity?
Yeah, I still am not so clear whether this falls into the realm of freedom of religion, this controversy I'm saying, because I think that the Dalai Lama is not banning people from practicing religion. It's more of a doctrinal issue. And it's a question whether an individual lama or individual the pope, whether the pope has the right to pronounce, make certain pronouncement. You can always question that, but that doesn't.
But if you lived in Tibet and the Dalai Lama, well, what would a free Tibet look like? Would it have the Dalai Lama as the leader there? Would it be a theocracy, and therefore what the leader of the religion said is what went for the government?
Yeah, that question is interesting. I think the Dalai Lama has looked into the future and thought that these questions would arise, and he has come out with the concrete pronouncements at regular intervals to prepare the Tibetan people for a future Tibet which is distinctly different from what Tibet was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, Tibet was an isolationist country, and religion was the dominant factor in Tibetan people's life. At that point of time, in a way, our people were independent. We did not depend on others, on our economy, on our other factors. But our future Tibet cannot afford to remain like that. So the Dalai Lama came out with pronouncements saying that in a future Tibet, he will not have any political role. He made it very clear.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, thereby indicating that future Tibet would be a secular country, a way the rule of law would have the distinctly dominant position, and where democracy will have full chance to practice its system.
Donald Lopez, what's your take? What would a free Tibet look like? Would it look as Mr. Sarang is saying? Would there be that freedom of religion so the followers of that deity, the Shugden, could continue to worship him?
Well, that deity was worshipped in Tibet over the past century or so. And again, exactly what the situation would be in a free Tibet is very hard to predict. And as Bujung Sering says, the Dalai Lama has said that he would step down and become exclusively a religious figure and give up his political role. But exactly how democratic institutions would be introduced into a country that doesn't have that tradition, I think, would be quite interesting. And of course, we're not talk, at least in the current stage of negotiations, we're talking about some kind of autonomy for Tibet within the People's Republic of China, with the goal of a completely independent Tibet being set aside, at least for the time being.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to tell you, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from National Public Radio News. And we have Diana with us in New York City. Hi, Diana.
Hello. I'm speaking as somebody who's practiced Tibetan Buddhism for maybe 15 years and who's volunteered and worked with a lot of Tibetan refugees. I think that this idea that people don't exactly know what they're getting into is being overplayed. If you ask anybody who is married or a parent or a doctor or a radio announcer what their first thought was when they were younger of what their life would be like, it probably doesn't match the reality. But if you stay with something, it's for a reason. I do think many Americans have an odd conception of Tibetan Buddhism.
How odd, in what way?
There's a great Lama, Lama Zopa, who actually printed up bumper stickers that said, "For happiness, cherish others."
Mm-hmm.
And as an American, you think, gee, if thousands of people are going to a rally about this, it must be that they misunderstood, because Americans are not into happiness, cherish others. But I think people get drawn in for an excellent reason, which is when you meet the monks and the nuns and Tibetan people, as a generalization, on average, they're saner and nicer and less bitter than many other people. And if you know somebody over time who does this practice, and I'm talking about the religion, I'm not talking about the culture, you'll see that it works well. Like friends of yours who start going to the gym, their bodies change. And friends of yours who do this practice, or if you yourself do this practice, there's almost a guarantee. You get to be nicer, you get to be saner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is really what people get drawn into.
Well, I'd like to pose a question to you. We just got an email from Dave who says, as a Christian, he tries to understand other faiths. And he wants to know, what should people of other faiths know about Tibetan Buddhism that would help them understand it better and eventually give it more respect?
The Dalai Lama has spoken a lot about how people who are Christian, Jewish, or of another tradition who are drawn to Tibetan Buddhism should make every effort not to convert. They should instead go back to their own traditions and ask their teachers to bring out the meditative traditions which are found in Christianity and Buddhism and Islam, and share those with them, and that they should do everything they can to find that richness. And he said he thought that perhaps that will be the gift of Tibetan Buddhism to the West, that everybody needs to find the practice that is a useful one for them, rather than running to something that seems new.
All right. Well, Diana, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. And we go to Paul in we're trying to get Paul in Iowa City. Hi there, Paul.
Hello. I wanted to comment about how I feel that Donald's point about how Tibetan Buddhism has been kind of glamorized by people in the West who don't have a real concept.
If you could turn your radio down, we could probably...
I'm sorry?
If you turn your radio down, you'd probably be able to talk faster.
I think that's a problem with my phone.
Oh, okay.
The radio's off.
Okay. But your question is?
My question is basically to Donald. If he can see the parallel that I'm drawing here with people who are in America, drawn to Native America, in a way that is parallel to people drawn to Tibet, as much we are removed from Native America in some ways, and people are drawn to that with no real concept of what goes on in Native America.
Well, I'll put that to Donald Lopez then. Donald Lopez?
Yes, well, I think that's certainly part of the case. We do have many Tibetan lamas living in the West now and teaching Tibetan Buddhism. But as I said, and especially I think in response to Diana's comment, many people do have this kind of ethnic stereotype about Tibetans. You describe them as saner and nicer and less bitter than others. This is not far from saying that they're colorful or childlike or a happy people. And I do think there's a certain danger in this kind of stereotyping, and I think it can be quite patronizing ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Buchung Sering?
Yeah, Professor Lopez, again... Isn't this trying to say that just to please one section of the community, we ought to say that Tibetans are not good people, that they indulge in these sort of things, just to look at a negative point of view?
No, I think we should simply say that Tibetans are like everybody else.
And exactly.
That they need their country back.
Yes, like everybody else who have their weaknesses, but who also have their strengths. And I think one drawback of your book has been that you tend to undermine the strengths of the Tibetan people. For example, during the break, I was telling our hostess about a beautiful exhibition that's going on here in the D.C. area at Smithsonian, Tibetan Buddhist Art of Healing. Your book doesn't at all touch that issue about the Tibetan culture. So these are strengths.
You're talking about Tibetan medicine?
Tibetan medicine and its effect and the whole interplay between medicine and religion.
Yeah, I think that remains to be sort of clinically proven, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if people are alive without disease, then it's...
And I think that's all the time we have for today. And we did get one email that wanted to clarify the point on Steven Seagal that he practices Aikido, a very Buddhist discipline, martial arts. So that's what our emailer had to say on that score. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for calling, and thanks to our guests, Buchung Sering, director of the International Campaign for Tibet. He joined us here in Washington Studio 3A. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Donald Lopez Jr., a professor of Buddhist and Tibetan Studies in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Michigan, author of Prisoners of Shangri-La, Tibetan Buddhism and the West. He joined us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you so much, Professor Lopez.
Thank you.
And a severe drought is the subject of tomorrow's Talk of the Nation at this time. Severe drought coupled with a 15-year civil war have led to mass starvation in southern Sudan. Talk of the Nation takes a look at the crisis in Africa's largest nation. In Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava, NPR News.